cliffcentral.com.
Another Renegade Report, your favorite podcast.
Well, the best one in the country. Oh, in the continent, I would assume, as well.
Southern Hemisphere. Screw the Australians.
Southern Hemisphere. Yeah, and the Argentinians, the bastards. Are you, what?
Yeah. I'm doing well.
Are you? Are you helping the poor and the ugly with their health issues? Does it give you satisfaction?
It's just a whole bunch of virtue signaling. My whole life, really. My whole job. Just complete virtue signaling.
But you don't tweet about it enough, I think.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of patient confidentiality issues. The SJWs are just waiting to hop on me the second I put a foot wrong on that. So I think I'll stick to my current strategy.
All right. Yeah, just save their lives. I think that should be okay.
Yeah, well, maybe. For some people, it's not good enough. Right, talking about saving lives, eh?
Yeah, not human ones, unless you're a vegan. Then you think they are humans. Animal lives. It's an important factor.
Yeah.
And the only way to do so is by
killing one. Animal lives matter.
Animal lives matter except for the one you hunt.
Yeah. All right. So this week, as you can hear, we're going towards something to do with animals and hunting. And do you want to introduce our guest?
Indeed. So our guest is Erdley Rudman. Erdley is a professional hunter. So, I mean, that's actually like a qualification. He's a professional hunter. He runs a lot of hunting specifically for foreign markets in South Africa. And he's very interested in conservation. So, Erdley, can you hear us?
Yes, Roman, Jonathan, I can hear you.
Fantastic. Welcome to the show, Erdley. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
No, the pleasure is all ours. So, excuse me. So, for those who don't know you, our listeners, just tell us a bit about yourself. What do you do? What is a professional hunter?
Well, a professional hunter is a person who's guiding, you know, hunting customers or clients, as we call them, obviously on a professional basis. In South Africa, the law is that you need to have a specialized license or permit to be able to guide people professionally. It's pretty much the custom in most of the countries where hunting is permitted in Africa. In America, you don't need a license to guide someone, but this is how it is in South Africa. You need a license. So I'm a licensed professional hunter, and I'm mainly operating on our private property here in the Eastern Cape.
Oh, so you have land for now?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, we own our family. It's a family operation, and we own a sizable portion of land over here. It's sort of contiguous, and it's large enough to accommodate a tremendous amount of wildlife and quite a few hunters. The market demands large areas, so it doesn't make too much sense hunting on a small property. So over the years, we have invested a lot in growing our operation, and that means buying additional property.
Tell me, Erdley, in terms of, you know, you're describing quite a large operation, a relatively decent-sized piece of land, a lot of wildlife. Tell us about the economy that creates, the jobs that creates.
It creates a tremendous amount of jobs directly and indirectly. I mean, we employ up to 10 different professional hunters. It's not just ourselves and the family. We have other professional hunters that we employ when the need arises, when we have excess customers or clients. And we have a large population of people living on our property, our staff, our workers, all involved in the operation as skinners, trackers, and a variety of other functions, you know, fence workers and so on. So we support in excess of 300 people, if you indirectly as well, if you take the families and people living, in towns that are dependent on our operation. So it's about 300 people.
All right. I mean, that's quite a sizable sizable amount of people that, that work there or who are affected by it. So, Eardley, when you advertise your farm or all the animals on it, I mean, who are your big clients?
Roman, it's mainly Americans. We target the American market because they have it's a massive outdoor industry that they have developed over there. I take my hats off to the Americans for doing that. It's tremendous how they develop everything over there. I mean, it's very much based on free market principles, especially Texas. You know, a lot of private property over there as well, privately owned wildlife. The state does manage quite a bit too, but the whole support industries that have developed, you know, the gear, you know, obviously firearms, all these other extras, it's a massive industry in the United States. And obviously we tap into that and we get a lot of our customers. More than half of our customers are actually repeat clients. We've had some people here that have been here about 12 times already. As I said, most of them are actually repeat customers. So that's very important. You know, if you can get repeat customers, you're obviously doing something right.
No, absolutely. The thing about Texas, which is quite odd, when I started hunting a decade ago or so, the sable antelope was extremely expensive and extremely rare, and the roan as well, I believe. And now I read about a year ago that the largest herds of sable are in Texas. In fact, not even in South Africa or Africa.
Yes. Texas does have a lot of exotics. They do extremely well there. They don't have very many problems with the authorities, you know, allowing them to have exotics. You know, in South Africa, we're getting problems from our department here for having species that are not indigenous. So in Texas, they allow that. You know, it's very, very much of a sort of a free market over there. But we obviously trying our best to do that as well. But we have such a huge variety of indigenous species here in South Africa that we don't really need too many exotics. But I know Texas has got a lot of scimitar horned oryx as well. And the scimitar horned oryx is basically extinct in its natural range. You don't find them in the Sahara Desert anymore. And Texas has got the most scimitar horned oryx in anywhere, I mean, you know, in the world now. And That is also just another accolade for them over there and how they manage their wildlife on a private basis.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. It opens up the entire debate on hunting for me and really the benefits or some of the benefits. Certainly, we've discussed the employment aspect of it. But it seems that people misunderstand what hunting means. So they take it as hunting is shooting an animal, therefore you're killing animals, and that's where hunting begins and ends. But it seems very obvious, as in the case that you've just cited, whereby hunting actually leads to conservation. So can you go into that a little bit more?
Yes. it's the incentivized conservation that's important. Yeah, you know, it's the private, the ownership principle. You know, we've been discussing it you know, a lot in the recent times, even on your podcast. Yeah, I've heard the word decentralization, certainly about our Eskom utility over here. You know, that's a major problem. And what in essence the private ownership principle effects is the incentive to conserve these species that have value. So we're not just going, just killing any animals and all the animals, the breeding stock, and that we're conserving, we're protecting the breeding stock, and only taking out the old males normally that you know as trophies or for the meat on a sustainable basis. You know, so. And as we do that, it's paying for itself. You know, it's sustaining itself as an economic unit. You know.
So, I mean, that is fairly, I believe, fairly common sense to most people, right? An animal is a commodity, and if that animal has value, you would want more of it. So you would hunt those that that have little value, and you keep those that you know breed, as an example.
Yes.
So so what do you make of trophy hunting? So last year, after Cecil the lion was killed in Zimbabwe, there was a massive outcry. Now, you can't eat a lion, as far as I know. So it's really there just to put, to stuff it and put its head on the wall in your living room. So what do you think about those sort of issues?
The lion issue is obviously, you know, very sensitive and very emotional. People are very emotionally attached to cats. I don't think there should be any differentiation between lions or any other antelope or any other, you know, huntable species. Incidentally, people do eat lion meat. I know in the East they eat the bones or use the bones a lot. So there is a demand for the bones too. So they do actually get eaten. And one of my favorite meats is actually caracal meat, you know, the rooikot.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if you've ever had any of that.
No.
It's actually very, very tasty. But so you can actually eat cats if you want to. But I know it's not politically whatever you want to call it, but you know people sort of frown upon eating cats. But the main thing is hunting trophy hunting of any species doesn't necessarily mean that it's just protecting that species. That income that's generated from lions or whatever animal that you possibly couldn't eat gets most of the time gets reinvested into the operation or into other species as well. So it's kind of intersectional, if you want to use a fancy word that you see a lot there on the internet. It's not just as simple as one species on its own every time. You know, you've got to think of it in the bigger picture.
Mm. So, I mean, I'm just trying to play devil's advocate as the kind of folk who will say, you know, but hunting's bad and hunting kills animals and there must be a better way and all of these things. And perhaps there is. I just want to understand, if tomorrow the government were to be lobbied to completely ban all hunting, so your entire operation becomes illegal overnight, there's no real point in you running your farm anymore, because unless you do something illegal, which wouldn't be, I assume, worth the risk. What ultimately is, in your opinion, the end point for the animals then?
Jonathan, yeah, unfortunately, you know, reality will set in, and those animals, wildlife that had a hunting value, which is most of the animals on private land has hunting value, they will be eliminated. Unfortunately, that is just the fact. I mean, it's sad that would happen, but you know, these operations all have taxes, have rates, have a lot of expenses, have people depending. So it will just get converted back to livestock farming. You know, this area where we're from, they used to farm a lot of goats, Angora goats, that absolutely destroyed huge areas of the natural habitat around here. And that will be the only option, really, is to go back to farming goats, Angora goats, and Boer goats.
Which would mean the other animals that are currently there, some of them relatively rare, would die out, essentially.
Absolutely. You know, wildlife can't really compete with a goat. A goat can eat, you know, almost rocks if it has to. So
nothing can compete with a goat, not even Taylor Swift. I don't know if you've seen that video. Yeah.
goats are very, very hardy, and obviously, that's why people farm them a lot, you know, the meat, the hair on the Maori. So they will marginalize the indigenous wildlife. You know, it's the habitat as well that gets protected with game farming, you know.
But there's also a precedent in Africa, right? So post-liberation, a lot of countries actually banned hunting entirely. And if you go to them, you walk through countryside where there are no animals whatsoever, no birds in the trees, no nothing whatsoever, because the local people have eaten all of it, or they have killed, you know, everything in sight. So there's a precedent already.
Yes, I mean, a quote is, you know, poverty is the biggest enemy of conservation. So if the people are hungry, they're going to eat whatever, you know, is there. If they don't have money, the first thing that they're going to do is turn on the wild animals and eat them. So it has to have value, you know, and obviously in South Africa we've been lucky that in 1991 the government allowed us to private to the ownership of the game, so it actually we could actually farm them and sell them, and that was a big turning point in the wildlife industry in South Africa, was it when they did that in 1991.
And currently now, I don't know, do you have the numbers for how much hunting adds to the economy?
Yes, the hunting industry, or the whole game ranching industry in South Africa, it's worth 20 billion each year. 20 billion that it injects into the economy, and that's just directly. You know, a lot of these people that we get, they spend about a week with us, and then they go down on a trip down the Garden Route or to Cape Town. Cape Town has marketed itself very, very well. People are very impressed with Cape Town. And they go and spend a week in Cape Town too, you know. So it's not just directly, but the direct amount is more or less 20 billion, sorry, rand into the economy. So that's quite sizable.
Okay, yeah, that is quite. And just on my side, Americans in general, the ones that you have to your farm, what do they particularly like to hunt? Because I assume that the lion and the rhino trophy hunting is actually quite rare, in fact.
Yes. You know, we don't have anything to do with the lions. You know, as I said, it's a personal thing that, and it's quite emotional. We don't have any lions on our property. There are places that facilitate lions, and you get, you know, the different types of lions, the managed ranch lions, and then you get the captive lions, and obviously the wild lions you find in the parks, but we don't have anything to do with that, but that's just a personal choice. I don't, you know, have any problem with people that want to go and hunt lions. You know, if the customer's happy to hunt a lion and under the certain circumstances, that's his, you know, that's his prerogative. But our main species here is the kudu, the natural occurring kudu in our bush. You know, my father and my great grandfather started many years ago looking after the habitat. Yeah, and we've got tremendous amount of kudu. We've probably got about 2,000 kudu on our property, and they're thriving over here. So kudus are our sort of flagship species here.
All right. Yeah, and they're quite bountiful. I mean, I've hunted a few. Very nice meat, by the way, if anyone wants them. Well, I don't have any at the moment, but when I do go hunt.
Next time, just send your orders to Ramon.
Yeah, 500 rand a kilo.
All right.
Yeah,
sorry, you were going to say kudu?
Now, kudus are excellent meat, lean meat. All the game meat, very similar. Actually, they you know, they taste very similar. But that's also another big money spinner, and it's going to grow even more and more. Is the meat industry? You know, the meat side of this whole industry that we have here.
So, if you want to be a healthy vegan, then you should eat game meat.
yeah.
All right. Tell us a bit about Sati's. So I assume we know absolutely nothing because, in fairness, people who aren't particularly interested in this area may not know anything about Sati's at all. So literally from what it is, where it started, and what we've ended up with now.
Yes, Sati's stands for the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora. You know, it was a group of countries that came together in the 1970s. I think it was about 1975. They came together and decided that they need to stop the trade of you know, mainly ivory and rhino horn between each other. You know, because they're signatories, so they want to stop it amongst each other, And obviously a lot of countries agreed to it, and it's grown. They've added a lot more countries to it. And it's I'm not sure exactly how many countries now, but it's about 170 countries or something like that. It's a tremendous amount. But obviously a problem that they have is that they rely on the signatories, on the countries themselves to impose these policies, you know, that they have, these restrictions. And there are three different categories. They have CITES 1, 2, and 3. And then these species are put onto these different ones according to how endangered they all are, or if they're threatened or whatever. So it's quite an involved situation, the CITES. And it's, as I said, it's grown a lot and it's changed. Unfortunately, it has been, what's the word? I don't want to really use hijacked, but it's been infiltrated by what they call the global north animal rights movement. And you mentioned earlier something about the SJWs, the social justice warriors. I sort of think of these people as the ecological, eco-equivalent of the SJWs that you spoke about. So they don't want people utilizing any of these animals at all. A lot of them are actually vegans and vegetarians, this type of thing. So they find it repulsive that people actually want to trade in any animal products, or obviously even eat meat, you know. So they oppose to any of that, and they've infiltrated CITES, unfortunately. And it's become, you know, a sort of a globalist operation there. They're trying to enforce their beliefs onto countries that are struggling. You know, we could all be benefiting from our resources over here. And I'll just quote something here. The ex Secretary General of CITES, Eugene Lapointe, I mean, he used to be involved in CITES in the early days. He was the Secretary General, and he's now, he has a quote here that he said a couple of days ago. Like the arrogant and paternalistic imperialists of the past, eco-colonialists believe that the environmental strictures that they have mapped out are environmentally superior to any other approaches. So, I mean, and this is an ex-Secretary General of CITES, you know, in the early days when they still had good intentions, and it's literally been hijacked by these sort of eco-Marxists or socialists, whatever you want to call them.
Just call them. Just call them eco-mentalists.
Yeah, you know, they try to enforce, and they want to use coercion and police and stuff like this onto people that they don't even have anything to do with, you know. And I just feel that's extremely unfair. These people sitting in the EU and the UN, it's off-site environmentalism, and I just feel it's completely wrong. You know, this is why the rhinos are getting poached and elephants are being depleted, because CITES is not working.
So what are the rules around ivory and rhino horn? Is it still like banned to trade in those commodities?
Yeah,
completely.
It's definitely rhino horn has had an international ban. In South Africa, it was still legal to trade rhino horn inside the country until a few years ago, and then they banned that as well. And more or less.
And then we went from 100 odd rhino dying a year to over 1,000.
Yeah, I think until about 2007, there were maybe three or four rhino being poached a year. Yeah, now it's increased by over 5,000%, because that market, you know, obviously somehow they were getting the rhino's horns out of the country, wherever it was going. But I mean, that was obviously illegal. But internally, it was being sold, bought and sold inside the country, and it was still legal then. So the ivory, there's also a complete ban now trading inside the country and across borders as well. Although South Africa, Zimbabwe, and I think Namibia are trying to change that. We're going to now, we've got this conference of parties, this COP17 coming up next week. And I believe that our country with Namibia and Zimbabwe are going to try and present a case to trade with the ivory, because we do have a lot of elephants in South Africa and Zimbabwe and Namibia. And to be honest, there'd be a lot more elephants on private property if it was legal to trade with ivory, you know?
Yeah, it always bugs me to no end when you see the tower of elephant tusks and they just burn it. You know, it was confiscated from poachers or whatever, and they just burn it. And you just think to yourself, you're making this commodity scarcer, you morons. And by making it scarcer, you're making it the
supply and demand.
Yeah, the price will increase exponentially, so there'll be more poaching.
Absolutely. You know, it's...
It boggles my mind.
But this is, you know, these are the type of people, unfortunately, that have now... You know, taken over these organizations. You know, highly organized as far as media goes, well funded. There are organizations funding them, so they're quite organized as far as getting into these big organizations and coercing governments. I'd hate to know if there's any corruption going on, but I'm pretty sure some money gets. It's, you know, handed over to kind of inflict or enforce their policies, you know.
We've had Avo Vector on the show before. We quite like his views, mainly because he presents quite a liberal approach and libertarian approach to things.
I just like him because he's white, to be honest.
Well, I mean, that goes without saying, Ramon. But what is your view on the rhino situation? Do you agree with him? Or should we be farming the rhino and opening up the market?
Yes, absolutely. Rhinos should be farmed like we farm cattle and sheep. I don't see any difference. I don't see why any animal or species should be any different to any other one. You know, you mentioned the libertarian outlook. I agree completely with that. Animals are humans are separate to the animals, and I don't see why any one species should be animal species or should be any different to any other one. And each rhino a year can produce 1 kilogram of horn, and that can be harvested, that can be cut off without having to kill the rhino. And a kilogram of rhino horn is worth 750,000 rand. So, and one rhino eats as much as two cows, just a little bit more than two cows a year. So, and a cow is only worth 4,000 or 5,000 rand. That takes a few years to sell. So it makes far more sense farming with rhinos than cows, you know. So I agree completely with Ivo Vector and that whole school of thought in farming these things. So I have no problem with that at all.
So are you telling me that the red plastic rhino horn at the front of my car doesn't actually do anything?
It does absolutely nothing. Just making those people rich that are selling them.
Damn it. I'm a 702. That's what they told me to get one.
Yeah.
No.
Tell us a little bit. You buy into the farming of rhino. It's the same kind of concept, I guess, as having a private wild game farm. It's the same concept in terms of keeping that resource for people who are interested in that market. You've mentioned the emotion around lions and cats.
Yes.
I think that that's a fair point. You know, the internet is essentially dedicated to cats, so it's a known fact that we really do value these creatures quite highly. And I buy the argument fully that you've already made, which is that humans are more important than animals. But we often get this portrayal of hunters as these kind of evil...
bloodthirsty.
Yeah, bloodthirsty, cruel to animals type of people. That's how they're portrayed as the eco-Marxists or whatever we're calling them, the eco-mentalists. You're very evil people. You basically carry a gun with you at all times. Guns are bad as well. And essentially, it doesn't really bother you harming animals and hurting animals. And every now and again, Carte Blanche will do some kind of expose on some kind of dodgy guy who doesn't do things properly and isn't probably licensed correctly, animals end up hurt and all these kinds of things. So
yes,
what's can we get a little bit of an other side to who hunters are and their care for the environment, or what they don't care about in the environment?
Yes. No, you got. That's a very good question, because I often, you know, on a lighter side, I often think of, you know, we need social justice warriors to stand up for us, because we are oppressed, you know. Hunters get oppressed. So if you see all the vitriol and the abuse that we get, we are actually oppressed. But anyway, we're tough enough. We can stand up against all that. I mean, we get our operation, we get emails almost every week from people in Britain or England or wherever, you know, telling us how disgusting we are and all that and type of thing. And then, you know, I'll just sometimes, if I feel like it, I'll reply in a logical way. And obviously I'll never get a reply. The first thing I always say, well, come speak to me in person, you know, and obviously that'll never happen. So these people, you know, are sitting behind keyboards and stuff a lot, and they're big stuff there. But in reality, you know, they won't approach us in person. But I always, would appreciate it if they did, because then we'd explain to them logically. And most people, if we ever have to, you know, explain, they would understand for sure. But yes, you know, it is quite disturbing to for a lot of people to get exposed to that type of abuse, you know. Coming back to, like you said, things that do go wrong in certain operations, you know, I mean, it's like any industry or job or whatever, or, you know, there will be bad apples. I mean, I think you're a doctor, Roman's a lawyer or attorney. There are bad eggs or apples in any profession. And the, you know, hunting or game farming industry, it's no different, you know. So to paint everyone with the same brush is extremely unfair, you know. But this is why I firmly believe in the free market and freedom of speech and all this. And it's a word I saw the other day that Roman used, was interlocute, you know. And it's good for us to be able to communicate with you, or try and communicate anyway, with these people, certainly on social media. And I think slowly but surely the tide is turning. You know, if you look at Instagram, our hunters are coming out in force over there and, you know, expressing themselves, what they do, you know, not just necessarily with a dead animal or something, but, you know, showing the meat they're carrying out in Alaska or Canada, the moose meat and stuff like that, and showing, you know, the outdoors. So there is certainly a pushback as far as all this goes. And this is why I like social media. Actually, a lot of people in our industry despise it. And actually, some even told me that it should be banned. I said, well, that's being a bit hypocritical. But anyway,
yeah.
We need to use all these and interlocute, you know, discuss, talk to people and educate, you know. So this is why I appreciate being on your show here. It's part of the education process. We're not all bad killers and bloodthirsty and that type of thing. We're the real conservationists are us hunters, the majority of us anyway, and we are the major majority.
So if you had to stand up, say there was a Greenpeace, I don't know, mob somewhere, and that you were invited to speak to them in 1 minute, how would you describe why hunting is actually very beneficial for their cause?
For the animals?
Yeah, for animals, right? So
yeah.
If you had to describe to people who disagree with you on this, how would you explain it?
Well, you know, you always read about it, and they say, you know, killing animals to save them is an oxymoron, you know. But that's like me saying, you know, growing your own food to eat it is an oxymoron, you know. So it's the same thing. We are protecting our resource because it has a value, and whether it's for hunting or for the meat or for photographic people that want to come and take photographs, we conserving, propagating our resource, you know. So if there was no commercial value on them, there'd be very little incentive to conserve and protect and obviously utilize that resource. And it's a very big resource for us people on marginal land. You know, we farm on marginal land, as I said earlier, and it's become a very valuable resource. And it could be even more valuable if certain of these restrictions are eliminated.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason why sheep are non-scarce, but gorillas are. Rest in peace, Harambe.
Harambe.
We do miss him, don't we?
Yeah,
But speaking about land, Erdley, so obviously land is a bit of a thorny issue for some people. So I assume you have a vast tracts of land and things like that. Has there been any issue in your part of the country about, has land been an issue with people in the community around you?
No, Roman, in our district over here, the farms were owned long before there was any even idea of apartheid. I mean, it was all title deeds in the 1800s already, or certainly early 1900s, long before 1948. So there was no forced evictions or anything around here in this part of the country. So we've had no land claims or anything here, and I don't think there will be much to come. In any case, the land claims that were 94 and 98, I think most of them have been settled already. There are just a couple of thousand that are still outstanding. But now this part of the country there weren't really a lot of locals around. In any case, there was no water here. We were a very dry place. We had to drill a lot of boreholes to extract water for animals. So there was no reason for anyone to want to come and live in this desert,
Yeah, I mean, that does make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And you are quite remote as well. What's your closest main sort of center?
Well, we actually kind of between Port Elizabeth and Graaf Reinet. In the Eastern Cape here. So I'd say we're closer to Port Elizabeth. But it is a very dry part of the country in any case. We're going through the driest, the worst drought in 100 years right now. It's actually affected this whole industry tremendously. A lot of people have lost a lot of hope and stuff. But, that's why we're fortunate that we've got quite a large, operation. So we can absorb that. But these smaller guys are failing. And unfortunately, there are a lot of properties in the market. So if anybody wants land, they can come and buy a lot of land around here.
Yeah, use free market principles for land reform. I'm quite a fan of that.
Absolutely,
All right. So, look, we've got CITES. You've mentioned the problem with CITES. You did allude to some of the government regulation. Give us a bit of a summary in terms of if we, in your opinion, because you sound like you're quite a liberal, also, obviously, you value the free market quite a lot. If we were to kind of fix it, so if you were in control and we could change this to get the best outcome, I assume you're a capitalist, so the best outcome is one in which you would do well from a business perspective, but it would also have the knock-on effects. I think many people don't understand about those principles.
Yes.
How would we do that? What changes need to be made? And be specific if you need to be.
Yeah. You see, we have a tremendous amount of legislation and regulations in place in this country. I mean, I think South Africa's probably got the most environmental regulations out of any country almost in the world. Obviously, how they implemented and enforced and all that's another story. But what it does do is create the impression that it's tremendously difficult to get involved in this industry, and what people call that barriers to entry. And they often talk about our industry. The wildlife or game ranching is only white older white men or whatever involved in it. And it needs to be transformed. And everybody scratches their head, yes, we need to transform this industry. And we all agree that we need more, black people, whatever. I don't like racial classification and stuff, but we're all just South Africans. But anyway, if we have to include previously disadvantaged people, then these barriers to entry create a tremendous a problem for people that are not really involved, and they think, well, how the hell are they ever going to get in here? Because they need 10 lawyers or something to understand all the you know proclamations and restrictions and requirements and things like this. So what needs to be done is that it needs to be liberated tremendously and make it much easier for people to get involved. I mean, and taxes. I mean, municipal rates. If you say you're a game farm, you get taxed the maximum amount. You know, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So you should almost be have free rates because you're trying to protect the environment. And yeah, they're taxing us because we're actually trying to protect the environment. We get taxed more, so that doesn't make any sense either. So it needs to be liberated tremendously. You know, our government is sort of progressive in a sense. So when people complain or whatever, then they want to change regulations according to how the people are complaining or making a big fuss about. So things are often, and then you'll get academics who give some sort of report or something, and then these officials will act on that. And there's not enough there's not enough consultation with the actual stakeholders in the industry with regards to changing these regulations and laws. You know, so it's becoming more and more restrictive. You know. So I just feel that the government should not get involved at all. And then you have like the veterinary side as well, you know, game farmers, vets, yeah. Mm. The farmers used to be able to dart their own animals and now they're not allowed to do that anymore, you know. So that's just made it even harder and more expensive to manage your own wildlife, because you can't dart your own animals. You know, this M99 drug, obviously they said no, but the people saw poaching rhinos with it, but I mean, you can poach a rhino with a silenced rifle if you want. So it's a bit too complicated, and the transformation aspect of it is suffering because of too many governmental restrictions.
So the state is strangling the industry. To steal from Ramon, I am utterly shocked. Shocked.
Absolutely gobsmacked.
Can't believe it. It's so essentially just deregulate quite a lot. What regulations would you keep? What things do you think are important to make sure that, you know, there isn't overt cruelty to animals, and that the general symbiosis of conservation versus hunting as a business can exist?
Well, the main thing is just theft and poaching. I mean, if the police or whatever authorities can just help with that, you know, with anti-crime and stuff like that needs to be in place. But as far as cruelty, I mean, how do you police that type of thing? You know, I believe the market will regulate itself as far as that type of thing goes. You know, we promote ourselves as a very ethical destination. I mean, we, as I said, more than half of our customers are all repeat. They like what's going on here. We have a website. We go to the shows in America. We have a big following. If there's a problem, it gets sorted out amongst ourselves. People don't come to you if they don't like your operation. And with the information age as we have it at the moment, I mean, you know, stories spread very quickly. So it's basically self-regulating as far as that goes. As I said, the government should have an absolute minimum involvement in this industry for it to really reach its potential and grow and transform.
Yep. So basically, as with all conclusions of our podcast, government, just stay the hell away, please, for God's sake. We don't need you.
Yes. I mean, we've reached the stage where we can manage all these things ourselves now. We've got the means, you know, we've got the resources. The internet's it's a fantastic thing. I mean, there was a big game sale today in Tabazumbi, and they sold a buffalo for $168 million. And it's a new record, you know, and stuff like this. I mean, it's fantastic what is possible. There's a lot of money. They sold some bottles of red wine. Anthony Rupert sold bottles of red wine. I don't know how many, a few few hundred thousand. It's all being donated, you know, voluntarily to a school for the less fortunate or something over there. And so there's a lot of charity going on a voluntary basis here. So government is actually not really needed here.
No, of course not. Even though 168 million rand for a glorified cow, that doesn't make sense to me. But it's not my money, so I don't really care.
I would never pay that. I would never pay it. But, I mean, that's between the buyer and the sellers.
Absolutely.
Early, thank you, sir. Really appreciate you coming onto the podcast. And if people want to save animals, go hunt them, basically. That's the main focus.
It's the biggest conservation success story in recent times. I mean, you take the Bonte book or Black Wildebeest, there were maybe 20 or 30 left about 60, 70 years ago, and look where they are now, thousands of them. The Bonte book, I mean, we have them, and I love our Bonte book. You know, we have them DNA tested, everything. And it's just fantastic, and it's only because of hunting that there's so many now.
Yeah, because there's a drive to conserve them. Well, thank you. I think we're going to call it. We're a bit short on studio time this week, but I really appreciate you coming on, giving us some insight into hunting. Those of you who are against this, I hope you've at least had your mind opened a little bit to this concept.
And those who aren't, you better be vegans, because factory farming is far worse, my friends.
Absolutely. I mean, those poor chickens. I mean, I don't eat chicken that from the shops because of that. I object to that.
Yeah. All right. So where can we find you on Twitter, just quickly?
My name, Erdley Rudman, E-A-R-D-L-E-Y, Rudman. That's it, Erdley Rudman.
So you can direct all your hate this one towards Erdley.
I've got a thick skin.
Yeah, Erdley, just respond with farms being slaughtered at the abattoir. But that's it. That's how you respond. Yeah. Anyway.
All right. Thank you so much, Erdley. All right, Ramon. Yep. So that's another show in the bag.
Indeed. Next one, we have a guest in mind. Hopefully he rocks up. It'll be interesting. But all our shows are great, as always.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you for listening. Keep supporting. Keep listening. Force other people to listen to us.
Yeah, so
I guess they will.
So as Ramon says, keep supporting. You know where to find us. Please also rate us on iTunes if you listen through iTunes. Tell your friends about the podcast, because it's more interesting than pretty much anything else you listen to. Thanks so much. We'll catch you next time. Bye. CliffCentral.com.